Vicky Campbell had selected 5 full-grown men from the RAS's camp attendants, rewarded each with a silver Maria Teresa dollar, and worn each of them down to a fine edge of exhaustion. One after the other, they'd taken hold of Miss Wobbly's crank handle and turned it like a squad of demented organ grinders, while Vicky shouted encouragement and threats at them from the driver's hatch, her eyes blazing and cheeks fiery with frustration. After an hour of this, she was convinced that sabotage had been employed to keep her safely out of the way, and she began to check out Miss Wobbly's internal organs. She was one of those unusual women who liked to know how things worked, and throughout her life had plagued a long series of mechanics, boyfriends and instructors with her questions. It was not enough for her to switch on a machine and steer it. She'd made herself an excellent driver and pilot, and in the process she'd acquired a fair idea of the workings of the internal combustion engine. "All right, Mr. Barton, let's find out what you've done," she muttered grimly. "Let's start on the fuel system." She rolled up her sleeves and tied a scarf firmly around her hair. Her 5 hefty helpers watched with awe as she approached the engine compartment and lifted the cowling. And then they crowded forward to get a good view and offer their advice. She had to beat them back and shoo them away before she could begin to work. But then she was completely absorbed in her task, and in half an hour had checked and tested the fuel system, making sure that gasoline was travelling freely from the tank along the lines to carburetor and cylinders, and that the pump was functioning smoothly. "Right, now let's check out the electrics," she muttered to herself, and turned irritably as an insistent hand tugged at her belt, breaking her concentration. "Yeah, what is it?" Her expression changed, lighting up happily as she saw who it was.
"Sara,"
she embraced the girl. "How on earth did you get here?"
"I escaped, Miss Camberwell. It was so boring in the hospital. I had my father's men bring a horse for me, and I climbed out of the window and rode down the gorge."
"Well, what about your friend, the young doctor?" Vicky demanded, still holding the girl and surprised by the strength of her affection for her.
"Oh, him."
Sara's voice held a world of scorn and contempt.
"He was the most boring thing in the hospital. Doctor, he knows nothing about how a body works. I had to try and teach him, and that was no fun."
"And your leg?" she asked. "How's your leg?"
"It is nothing. Almost well."
Sara tried to dismiss the injury, but Vicky saw that she was drawn and haggard. The long, rough ride down the gorge must have taxed her, and as Vicky led her tenderly to a seat in the shade of the acacias, she favoured the injured leg heavily.
"I heard there's going to be a battle. That's really why I came. I heard the Italians are advancing."
She looked around her brightly, seeming to thrust her pain and weariness aside.
"Where are Jake and Gareth? Where is Gregorius? We must not miss the battle, Miss Camberwell."
"That's what I'm working on." Vicky's smile faded. "They've left us behind."
"What?"
Sara's bright look became bellicose, and then outraged as Vicky explained how they'd been edged out.
"Men, you cannot trust them," fumed Sara. "If they aren't trying to tip you on your back, then it's something worse. We aren't going to let them do it, are we?"
"No," Vicky agreed. "We are most certainly not." With Sara beside her, it was impossible to continue her work on the armoured car, for the girl made up for a total ignorance of the mechanism by an unbounded curiosity, and when Vicky should have been inspecting the magneto, she found instead that she was looking closely at the back of Sara's head, which had been interposed. After she'd forcibly elbowed her aside for the 6th time, she asked with exasperation,
"Do you know how to fire a Vickers machine gun?"
"I am a mountain girl," boasted Sara. "I was born with a gun in one hand and a horse between my legs." "Or what have you," murmured Vicky, and the girl grinned impishly. "But have you ever fired a Vickers?"
"No,"
admitted Sara reluctantly, and then brightened. "But it won't take me long to find out how it works." "There." Vicky indicated the thick, water-jacketed barrel that protruded from the turret. "Go ahead." When Sara scrambled awkwardly onto the sponson, still favouring the leg, Vicky could return to her inspection. It was another half hour before she exclaimed,
"He's taken the carbon rod out of the distributor. Oh, the sneaky swine."
Sara's head popped out of the turret.
"Gareth?" she asked. No, answered Vicky. Jake. I didn't expect it of him. Sarah climbed down beside Vicky to inspect the damage. They're all the same. Where's he hidden it? Probably in his own pocket.
What are we going to do?
Sarah wrung her hands anxiously.
We'll miss the battle.
Vicky thought a moment, then her expression changed.
In my bag, in the tent, is an ever-ready flashlight.
There's also a leather cosmetic case. Bring them both to me, please. One of the flashlight dry cell batteries, split open by the curved blade of the dagger from Sarah's belt, yielded a thick carbon rod from its core, and Vicky shaped it carefully with the nail file from her cosmetic case until it slipped neatly into the central shaft of the distributor and the engine fired at the first swing of the crank.
You are really very clever, Miss Camberwell, said Sarah,
with such patent and solemn sincerity that Vicky was deeply touched. She smiled up at the girl who stood above the driver's seat, her head and shoulders in the turret and her knees braced against the back of the driver's seat.
Think you can work that gun yet? She asked.
And Sarah nodded uncertainly and placed her slim dark hands on the clumsy mahogany pistol grips, standing on tiptoe to squint through the sights.
Just take them to me, Miss Camberwell.
Vicky let out the clutch and swung the car in a tight lock, out from under the acacia trees and onto the steep, rocky track, which led to the wide-open grassland on the funnel of the mountains.
I am very angry with Jake,
declared Sarah, clutching wildly for support as the car pounded and thumped over the rough track.
I did not expect him to behave this way, hiding the carbon rod. That is more like Gareth. I am disappointed in him.
You are?
Yes, I think we should punish him.
How?
I think Gareth should be your lover,
Sarah stated firmly.
I think that is how we will punish Jake.
In between wrestling with the heavy steering and dancing her feet over the steel pedals of brake and clutch, Vicky thought about what Sarah had said. She thought also of Jake's broad, rangy shoulders and thickly muscled arms. She thought about his mop of curly hair and that wide, boyish grin that could change so quickly to a heavy frown. Suddenly she realized how very much she wanted to be with him, and how she'd miss him if he were gone.
I must thank you for sorting out my affairs for me, she called to the girl in the turret. You have a knack. It's a pleasure, Miss Camberwell, Sarah called back. It is just that I understand these things.
As the afternoon wore on, so thunderheads of cloud formed up the mountains in the west. They soared into the sky of endless sapphire blue, smoothly rounded masses of silver that rolled and swirled with a ponderous majesty, swelling high and darkening to the colour of ripening grapes and old bruises. Yet over the plain the sky was open, clear and high, and the sun burned down and heated the earth so that the air above it shimmered and danced, distorting vision and distance. At one moment the mountains were so close that it seemed that they reached to the heavens, and they must topple upon the small group of men, crouched in the shade of the two concealed armoured cars, and the next they seemed remote and miniaturised by distance. The sun had heated the hulls of the cars so that the steel would blister skin at a touch, and the men who waited, all of them except Jake Barton and Gareth Swales, crawled like survivors of a catastrophe beneath the hulls, seeking relief from the unrelenting sun. The heat was so intense that the gin rummy game had long been abandoned, and the two white men panted like dogs, the sweat drying instantly on their skins and crusting into a thin film of white salt crystals. Gregorius looked to the mountains and the clouds upon them and said softly, "Soon it'll rain." He looked up to where Jake Barton sat like a statue on the turret of Priscilla the Pig. Jake had swathed his head and upper body in a white linen chamois to protect it from the sun, and he held the binoculars in his lap. Every few minutes he would lift them to his eyes and make one slow sweep of the land ahead before slumping motionless again. Slowly the shadows crept out from the hulls of the cars. The sun turned across its zenith and gradually lost its white glare. Its rays toned with yellows and reds. Once again, Jake lifted the binoculars,
and this time paused midway in his automatic sweep of the horizon. In the lens, the familiar dun feather of the distant cloud once again wavered softly at the line where pale earth and paler sky joined. He watched it for 5 minutes, and it seemed that the dust cloud was fading, shriveling, and that the shimmering pillars of heat-distorted air were rising, screening his vision. Jake lowered the glasses, and a warm flood of sweat broke from his hairline, trickled down his forehead into his eyes. He swore softly at the sting of salt and wiped it away with the hem of the linen shammer. He blinked rapidly and then lifted the glasses again and felt his heart jump in his chest and the prickle of rising hair on the nape of his neck. The freakish currents and whirlpools of heated air cleared suddenly, and the dust cloud that minutes before had seemed remote as the far shores of the ocean were now so close and crisply outlined against the pale blue-white sky that it filled the lens. Then his heart jumped again. Below the rolling, spreading cloud, he could make out the dark insect shapes of many swiftly moving vehicles. Suddenly, the viscosity of the air changed again, and the shapes of the approaching column altered, becoming monstrous, looming through the mist of dust, closer, every second closer, and more menacing. Jake shouted, and Gareth was beside him in an instant. "Are you crazy?" he gasped. "They'll overrun us in a minute." "Get started," Jake snapped. "Get the engines started," and slid down into the driver's hatch. There was a flurry of sudden, frantic movement around the cars. The engines were cranked into reluctant life, surging and missing and backfiring as the volatile fuel turned to vapor in the heat and starved the engines. The RAS was lifted into the turret of Gareth's car by half a dozen of his men-at-arms and installed behind the vicar's gun. Their job accomplished, his men were leaving him and hurrying to mount their ponies when the RAS let out a series of shrieks in Amharic and pointed at the empty cave of his own mouth, devoid of teeth and big enough to hibernate a bear. There was a brief moment of consternation until the senior and eldest man-at-arms produced a large leather-covered box from his saddlebag and hurried with it to kneel humbly on the sponson of the car and proffer the open box to the RAS. Mollified, the RAS reached into the box and brought out a magnificent set of porcelain teeth, big and white and sharp, enough to fit in the mouth of a derby winner, complete with bright red gums. With only a short struggle, he forced the set into his mouth and then snapped them like a brook trout rising to the fly, before peeling back his lips in a death's head grin. His followers cooed and exclaimed with admiration, and Gregorius told Jake proudly, "My grandfather only wears his teeth when he is fighting or pleasuring a lady." And Jake spared a brief glance from the advancing Italian army to admire the dazzling dental display. "Makes them look younger. Not a day over 90. He gave his opinion and revved the engine, carefully manoeuvring the car into a hull-down position below the bank, from where he could keep the Italians under observation. Gareth brought the other car up alongside and grinned at him from the open hatch. It was a wicked grin, and Jake realized that the Englishman was looking forward to the coming clash with anticipation. It was no longer necessary to use binoculars. The Italian column was less than 2 miles distant, moving swiftly on a course that was carrying it parallel to the dry riverbed. Beyond the curved horns of the ambush, into the open, unprotected funnel of flat land between the mountains. Another 15 minutes at this rate of advance, and it would have turned the Ethiopian flank, and would be able to drive without resistance to the mouth of the gorge. And Jake knew better than to hope to be able to reorganize the rabble of cavalry once their formations were shattered. Instinctively, he knew that they would fight like giants as long as the tide carried them forward, but any retreat would become a rout, and they would race for the hills like factory workers at 5 o'clock. They were accustomed to fighting as individuals, avoiding set-piece battles, but snatching opportunity as it was offered, swift as hawks, but giving instantly before any determined thrust by an enemy. "Come on," he muttered to himself, pounding his fist against his thigh impatiently. And with the first stirring of alarm, unless the bait was offered within the next few moments,
Because they fought as individuals, each man his own general, and because the art of ambush and entrapment came as naturally to the Ethiopian as the feel of a rifle in his hand, Jake need not have fretted. Seeming to rise from the flat, scorched earth under the wheels of the leading Italian vehicles, a small, galloping knot of horsemen flitted across the heat-tortured earth, seeming to float above it like a flock of dark birds, their shapes wavering and indistinct. Wrapped in pale streamers of dust, they cut back obliquely across the Italian line of march, running hard for the centre of the hidden Ethiopian line. Almost instantly, a single vehicle detached itself from the head of the column and headed on a converging course with the flying horsemen. Its speed was frightening, and it closed so swiftly that the squadron of cavalry was forced to veer away, forced to edge out towards where the two armoured cars were hidden. Behind the single speeding vehicle, the Italian column lost its rigid shape. The front half of it swung away in a long, untidy line, abreast in pursuit of the horsemen. These were all larger, heavier vehicles with high canvas-covered cupolas, and their progress was ponderous and so slow that they couldn't gain perceptibly on the galloping horses. However, the smaller, faster vehicle was gaining rapidly. Jake stood higher to give himself a better view as he refocused the binoculars. He recognized instantly the big open Rolls-Royce Tourer that he'd last seen at the Wells of Chaldee, its polished metalwork glittering in the sunlight, its low, rakish lines enhancing the impression of speed and power as the dust boiled out from behind its spinning rear wheels and their huge, flashing central bosses. Even as he watched, the Rolls braked and skidded broadside, coming to a halt in a furiously billowing cloud of dust. A figure tumbled from the rear seat. Jake watched the man brace himself over the sporting rifle and the spurt of gun smoke from the muzzle as he fired seven shots in quick succession, the rifle kicking up abruptly as the recoil and the thud-thud of discharge reached Jake only seconds later. The horsemen were drawing swiftly away from the Rolls, but neither the changing range nor the dust and mirage affected the marksman. At each shot, a horse went down, sliding against the earth, legs kicking to the sky, or plunging and rolling as it struggled to regain its legs, falling back at last and lying still. Then the riflemen leapt aboard the Rolls again, and the pursuit was continued, gaining swiftly on the survivors. The heavy phalanx of trucks and troop transports lumbering on behind it. The whole mass of horses, men and machines rolling steadily deeper into the killing ground that Gareth Swales had so carefully surveyed and laid out for them. "The bastard," whispered Jake, as he watched the Rolls skid to a standstill once more. The Italian was taking no chances of approaching the horsemen closely. He was standing well off, out of effective range of their ancient weapons, and he was picking them off one at a time, in the leisurely fashion of a shotgunner at a grouse shoot. In fact, the whole bloody episode was being played out in the spirit of the hunt. Even at that range of almost 1,000 yards, Jake seemed able to sense the blood passion of the Italian marksman, the man's burning urge to kill merely for the sake of inflicting death, for the deep gut thrill of it. If they intervened now, cutting into the flank of the widespread and disordered column, they might save the lives of many of the frantically fleeing horsemen, but the Italian column was not yet fully enmeshed in the trap that had been laid. Swiftly, Jake traversed the glasses across the dust-swirling and heat-distorted plain, and for the first time he noticed that a dozen trucks of the Italian rearguard had not joined the mad, tear-ass, helter-skelter stampede after the Ethiopian horsemen. This small group had halted, seemingly under some strict control, and now they'd been left 2 miles behind the roaring, dusty avalanche of heavy vehicles. Jake could spare no more attention to this group, for now the slaughter was being continued, the wildly flying horsemen being cut down by the crack riflemen from the Rolls. The temptation to intervene now overwhelmed Jake. He knew it was not the correct tactical moment, but he thought, "To hell with it. I'm not a general. Those poor bastards over there need help." He shoved his right foot down hard on the throttle, and the engine bellowed. But before he could pull forward and run at the bank, he was forestalled by Gareth Swales. He'd been watching Jake, and the play of emotion over his face was plain to read. At the moment he revved the engine, Gareth swung the front end of the hump across his bows, blocking him effectively.
"I say, old chap, don't be an idiot," Gareth called across the narrow space. "Calm the savage breast, you'll spoil the whole show."
"Those poor—"
Jake shouted back angrily.
"They've got to take their chances,"
Gareth cut him short.
"I told you once before your sentimental old-fashioned ideas would get us both into trouble."
At this stage the argument was drowned by the Ras. He was standing tall in the turret above Gareth. He'd armed himself with the broad two-handed war sword, and now the excitement became too much for him to bear longer in silence. He let out a series of shrill, ululating war cries and swung the sword in a great hissing circle around his head, both the silver blade and his brilliant set of teeth catching the sun and flashing like semaphores. He punctuated his shrill war cries with wild kicks at his driver, urging him in heated Amaric to have at the enemy, and Gareth ducked and twisted out of the way of his flying feet.
"Bunch of maniacs," protested Gareth as he dodged. "I've got myself mixed up with a bunch of maniacs."
"Major Swales,"
shouted Gregorius, unable to stay out of the argument a moment longer.
"My grandfather orders you to advance."
"You tell your grandfather to—"
But Gareth's reply was cut short as a foot caught him in the ribs.
"Advance!"
shouted Gregorius.
"Come on, for Christ's sake!"
yelled Jake.
"Yahoo!"
hooted the Ras, and swung around in the turret to wave on his men at arms. They needed no further invitation. In a loose mob, they spurred their ponies past the stymied cars and, brandishing their rifles above their heads, robes streaming in the wind like battle ensigns, they lunged up the steep bank into the open and galloped furiously onto the flank of the scattered Italian column.
"Oh, my God," sighed Gareth.
"Every man a bloody general."
"Look,"
shouted Jake, pointing back down the course of the dry riverbed, and they all fell abruptly silent at the spectacle. It seemed as though the very earth had opened, disgorging rank upon rank of wildly galloping horsemen. Where a moment before the sweep of the land below the mountains had been empty and silent, now it swarmed with men and horses, hundreds upon hundreds of them, dashing headlong upon the lumbering Italian column. The dust hung over it all, rolling forward like the fog off a winter sea, shrouding the sun, so that the horses and machines were dark infernal shapes below the somber clouds, and the ruddy sun glinted dully on the steel of rifle and sword.
"That does it,"
Gareth agreed bitterly, and reversed his car to clear Jake's front, before swinging away, engine roaring and the wheels spinning for purchase in the steep, loose earth of the riverbank. Jake turned wide of the other car and took the bank at an angle to lessen the gradient, and the two cumbersome machines burst out into the plain, wheel to wheel. Before them was the open flank of massed, soft-skinned vehicles, as tempting a target as they'd ever been offered in their long and warlike careers. The two iron ladies swept forward together, and it seemed to Jake that there was a new tone to the deep engine note, and so they sensed that once again they were fulfilling the true reason for their existence. Jake glanced quickly at the hump as she sailed along beside him, her angular steelwork with its flat, abrupt surfaces, from which rose the tall turret, still gave her the ugly, old maidish silhouette. But there was a new majesty in the way she plunged forward. Her bright Ethiopian colours fluttered gaily as a cavalry pennant, and the high, thin-rimmed wheels spurned the sandy earth like the hooves of a thoroughbred. Beneath him, Priscilla drove forward as gamely, and Jake felt a warm flood of affection for his two old ladies.
"Have at them, girls!" he shouted aloud.
And Gareth Swales, head protruding from the driver's hatch of the hump, turned towards him. There was a freshly lit cheroot, clamped in the corner of his mouth. It seemed to have sprouted there miraculously of its own accord. Gareth grinned around it.
"Noli illegitimi carborundum!"
Jake caught the words faintly above the roar of wind and motor, then turned his full attention back to controlling the racing machine and bringing her as swiftly as possible into the gaping breach of the Italian line.
Abruptly, the pattern of movement ahead of him changed. The exultantly pursuing Italian warriors had realized belatedly that the roles had been neatly switched.